All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here under the doctrine of anger. We are looking under subpoint J here, under point 4F, Jonathan's anger against the negative volition of his father Saul as he manifested in his unrighteous treatment of David. Of course, Saul was a believer who'd gotten under his STA because a number of factors. He'd been rejected by God. And was going to be replaced by David, and he knew this. And so he wasn't a happy camper, at the very minimum. Saul has a son, Jonathan, and Jonathan and David are good friends. And Jonathan is also smart enough to recognize the spiritual issues involved here. Jonathan applied most of the time pretty well. The only time he really failed was at the end of his life when he didn't separate from his father, which he should have done, and aligned himself with David, but he didn't do that, so that ultimately cost him. But here in 1 Samuel 20, verse 34, Saul's anger, of course, burns against Jonathan in verse 30, and he said, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." I guess he needed some Orbit gum to clean up that potty mouth. He probably would have used other words. But anyway, he recognized that Jonathan was aligning himself in some ways with David, and Saul didn't care for it. And then Jonathan asked him, you know, why should David be put to death, verse 32, what has he done? And he hasn't done anything. But then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew his father had decided, this is an example of unrighteous anger here. Then you have the righteous indignation in verse 34. Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat any food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. And here he recognizes Saul's unrighteous treatment of David is completely out of line. And so he responds to this with righteous indignation, that David should not have been treated this way. David was in fact a hero in Israel and should have been honored as such. G. Nehemiah's anger against the extortion being practiced by the Jewish leadership, Nehemiah 5:6. This comes about during the time when they are attempting to rebuild Jerusalem, and they're facing a number of obstacles, not the least of which is their enemies. One of the things that happened during this time is that there became a complaint registered in verse 1 of chapter 5, against their Jewish brothers. There was a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many, therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live. And there were others who said, we are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our houses so that we might get grain because of the famine. And there also were those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers and children, and yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slave, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already, and we are helpless because our fields and vineyards belong to others. Verse 6, then I was very angry when I heard their outcry in these words. I consulted with myself. Nehemiah didn't go ask for any advice from anybody else. He just ran this through his own doctrinal grid and came to a conclusion and contended with the nobles and rulers and said to them, you are exacting usury, each of you his brother. So I held a great assembly against them. And he basically said, we've done all we can financially, and you're still trying to extract money from these people, give them back their fields, and leave off with this usury. Which is, again, excessive interest rates on loans. Usury is not, again, decreeing against no interest rates on loans. It's decreeing against oppressive and excessive interest rates on loans. So basically they listened to him, finally, and did what he said and basically left off with this. But these people were suffering, and these other people were attempting, their Jewish brothers were attempting to make money off of this. Very bad situation. H. David's anger against the man in the parable of Nathan, 2 Samuel 12:5. Unfortunately for David, he doesn't recognize that the man in the parable is him. But his righteous indignation kicks in when he hears the story, not recognizing that he is the object of this teaching. 2 Samuel 12:5, the Lord sent Nathan to David. Now this is because David had not rebounded the issue with the murder of Uriah and adultery with Bathsheba. And David had been warned. David was under discipline. This dragged on for almost a year. Finally, God sends Nathan to rebuke David. And he tells him this story in the first four verses. There were two men in one city, one rich, the other poor. The rich man had great many flocks and herds, and the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and his children, and it would eat his bread and drink his cup and lie in his bosom and was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger burned greatly against the man, and he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives." See, even here's David, essentially in reversionism, and wouldn't rebound, and he still hasn't lost certain standards. This is kind of the irony of it. But under all of this, of course, you have to factor in David is positive. Now, if a person goes into reversionism and they're negative, their standards are going to be eroded quickly. But David was positive underneath this, even though he was having this difficult area in his sin nature that he wasn't dealing with. And as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. He must make restitution for the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing and had no compassion. Nathan then said to David, "You are the man. This is about you, idiot." God basically says, "Look, I gave you every opportunity, and look what you did." And then David finally rebounds here down about verse 13. David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." So a part of the discipline was God killed their firstborn, killed the first child between David and Bathsheba. So that was a judgment on David. And as he also said, there's going to be ongoing discipline because of this. Ironically, verse 24, David comforted his wife Bathsheba, went in to lay with her, and she gave birth to a son, and he named him Solomon. Go figure. Now the Lord loved him and sent word through Nathan the prophet. Okay, and I, the owner of the unforgiving slave, there we saw in Matthew 18:34, the slave owner forgives a very great debt to one of his slaves. And with one of his slaves. And he goes in to settle him up. And this, again, is analogous to our sin debt with God. We could not repay. It's beyond our capacity, our ability. And so this guy owes, whatever it is, $20 billion or something. And he has compassion, the king does, releases the slave from the debt. Slave goes out and begins to choke his fellow slave. Essentially, you know, it's sinning every day and rebounding and then refusing to forgive when some believer sins against you. This is the nature of this parable. It's about forgiveness. When his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were deeply grieved. And they reported it back to their Lord what had happened. And his Lord, verse 34, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers until he should repay all that was owed. He's going to be in the torturers, by the way, for the rest of his life, because he could never repay that debt. And that's the idea. Again, the whole parable is in regard to failure to forgive in light of the number of times God forgives us. And how many times have you committed the very same sin? I mean, over and over and over and over and over and over again. And rebounded, and God's done the same thing every time. He's forgiven you every time. It doesn't mean you can't, you know, some people take that as a license. Okay, well, I can just sin and rebound. I don't have to worry about it. Well, that's not true, but that is one take on it, but it's not true. We're not saying that there is no discipline for sin. But we are saying that you can get forgiveness simply by rebounding every time, and you've committed the same sin multitudes of times in your life, probably hundreds, if not thousands, the very same sin that you've had to rebound. And yet God doesn't say, well, now you've done this one too many times, this is it. You obviously should strive to deal with that sin. You should not capitulate to it. Paul deals with this in Romans 6 there, about what are we going to say then? Should we just continue under the STA so that grace can abound? Hey, God forgives me and extends grace to me when I rebound. Okay, well then I should keep sinning. No, that's not Paul. Paul answers that in the strongest terms. May such a thing never be. Well, Roman numeral 5 here, the unrighteous anger of man. A, there can be no doubt that the vast majority of anger does not fall into the category of righteous indignation, but is a product of the old sin nature. B, the scriptures make it plain that anger is a mental attitude sin that originates in the sin nature. Further, believers are to seek to overrule sinful anger. Galatians 5, 19 and 20. It's an issue we all have to deal with. And knowing what I know about doctrine, teaching this doctrine is probably going to stir up your grid. You're probably going to be exposed to stuff now. Probably already started. But it'll continue on. Now that you're exposed to this, then the doctrine you get gets tested. This is something we teach at a fundamental level, that all doctrine is going to be tested. But particularly when we deal with certain doctrines, I've observed over the years that then people are challenged with that very doctrine, with the anger grid. So don't be surprised if it rears its ugly head this week or next or whenever, or if it already has. Galatians 5, 19 and 20, the deeds of the flesh are evident. And then verse 20, one of those is outbursts of anger. And then this often results, again, in these other things, disputes, dissensions, the argumentative, bitter strife that comes out of that. Ephesians 4, 31. That's a, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Again, the malice is a mental attitude sin of desiring to harm others. And Colossians 3:8. So, again, you should wish harm on no one. There's not a place for that. You don't know what they did to me. Well, it doesn't matter what they did to you now, does it? The Bible doesn't qualify this that I can tell. You can have a little malice. Just keep a little malice because you might need it. No. Put them all aside. That's the whole idea. Colossians 3:8, put all aside to these things. Anger, wrath, again, synonyms in some ways, but there's each has their own subtle nuance. Malice, slander, and abusive speech out of your mouth. See, Jesus taught that anger is mental attitude murder. This is another one of the reasons for the serious nature of this sin. Why? Because out of anger arises the overt act of murder. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to happen every time. You can get angry and not kill somebody, or you can lose your cool and kill somebody. And people have done that. That's why once a fight starts, you never know where it's going to end. So you're wiser just not to get engaged in it. If things start to escalate, walk away. And again, it's to the glory of man to observe an affront. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder. And whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, or empty head, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. His contemporaries among the Jews had been educated in the Mosaic law and knew that it prohibited murder. You can see 9:6 Genesis there, where murder was prohibited after the flood and reiterated in the Mosaic law, you shall do no murder. Thou shalt not kill is literally you shall not murder. There is sanctified killing, obviously. See, you know, you got the vegans out here going to teach you can't murder an animal. It's murder. It's not murder. You can't murder anything without a soul. You have to have a soul to be murdered. Capital punishment is murder. No, it's not. It's sanctified by the word of God. You can't fight in the military. You know, you got these peaceniks, certain religious groups. Like the Friends, if you're familiar with them, the Friends Society. They don't believe in war, so they abstain from, you know, war on religious basis, because it's murder. No, it's not murder. It's not murder to kill somebody in warfare. There are a number of things that are not murder. Murder is premeditated harm, taking the life of someone else for no reason. or for a reason you deem fit, but not a legitimate reason. So too, the Mosaic law taught that the punishment for murder was death, a fact that Jesus never disputed. Numbers 35, 29 through 34. And this was established, by the way, again, coming out of the flood to Noah, that if a man sheds another man's blood, by a man his blood will be shed. And the human race is responsible for maintaining civil order by enforcing capital punishment. If you don't enforce capital punishment, you are headed towards anarchy and chaos. And let's see what we have today. Oh, anarchy and chaos. Prisons full of people that should be dead. So Numbers 35, rather. These things shall be for a statutory ordinance to you throughout your generation and all your dwellings. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses. But no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. In other words, if you killed somebody and there was only one witness to the fact, you couldn't be executed. You got away with it. You say, well, that's, why would God allow that? Simply put, it was to avoid malicious prosecution. So there had to be some facts, some evidence, some witnesses to corroborate this deal. And this is designed to protect society. Moreover, you shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer. Who is guilty of death, he shall be surely put to death. You shall not take ransom for him who has fled to a city of refuge, that he may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. You shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed, except by the blood of him who shed it. In other words, there's a sense in which this defiles your country. And your country is going to remain defiled until this issue is dealt with. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell. For I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. So three, however, their thinking on this matter was correct as far as it went. Although it was correct, their understanding of the law was superficial and did not address the root cause of murder. For the words in Jesus in Matthew 5 are not intended to contradict or change the prohibition against murder. They are intended to demonstrate that the righteousness of the kingdom demands much more than simply refraining from overt murder. And to be a righteous person, you say, well, I'm righteous, I don't kill anybody. Well, yeah, but are you angry with people? Do you walk around consumed with anger? Well, then you're a murderer. And the righteousness of the kingdom demands more than just overt compliance with certain laws. It demands an internal compliance. Again, true righteousness is found in the mental attitude, not just simply because you're overtly squeaky clean. There are a lot of people out there that are overtly squeaky clean. If you examine their life, you say, well, they're clean. But they're engaged in all kinds of stuff that you don't know about, and a whole bunch of stuff in the mental attitude. Five, his teaching is designed to make them understand that mental attitude anger is not only the root cause of murder, but it also brings judgment on the individual that engages in it. Six, he presents three scenarios that are all precursors to the potential of overt murder, with each case carrying a progressively greater judgment. Seven, the first example deals with a believer that is angry with another believer and will not rebound the sin and resolve the issue. In that regard there, in Matthew 5, Jesus deals with this issue and says, look, the first one is clearly addressed to, he uses the word brother, in fact. Everyone who is angry with his brother. And the second one uses the same thing. Whoever says to his brother. Now see, you got, and each case gets progressively worse. The first one's angry with his brother, but there's no mention that he says anything to him. The second guy is angry with his brother, but he says to him, you good for nothing, or you empty head. And then finally, the third one doesn't mention a brother. It just says, whoever says you fool. So there are some differences in here that are significant. The first one is the implacable believer. A part of the anger complex gets into implacability, the refusal to resolve issues. And people that will not resolve issues are what we call implacable. They are not going to change their mind. They are entrenched in their position, and they're going to stay there, and they're never going to compromise. To them, this is beyond the realm of possibility. Well, this is an example of negative volition, as it's taught, say, in 2 Timothy 3 there. That's one of the characteristics of the last days, that they will not compromise, that they are implacable. So, A, this person is guilty before the Lord and subject to judgment. And the phrase liable to the court could be translated guilty and deserving of condemnation. B, this must refer to divine discipline or judgment, since no human court is competent to try a case of mental attitude anger. Who's going to try that case? You can't. It's in the mental attitude. And for all the multitudes of laws that we have, I don't know that we have a law against anger. Because you can't prove it. You cannot go in and say, okay, you're mentally angry, we're going to discipline you. Well, you can't prove it. The only one who knows what I think is me. See, this example deals with the believer that will not judge himself. And, of course, as a part of the Christian life, we are exhorted to judge ourselves regularly and to judge ourselves righteously. And sometimes, of course, that's not pleasant because we look at ourselves and we don't like what we see in the mirror. Well, but you still have to be intellectually honest and admit that you don't like what you see, but it's because you're wrong. 1 Corinthians 11:31, and here in the context of the Lord's table, but if we judged ourselves rightly, this means with right standards, consistently, and dealing with the issues as they truly are, not rationalizing things, not the way we'd like it to be, but the way it really is, we would not be judged, i.e. we wouldn't come under God's judgment if we judge ourselves. If you discipline yourself and all of that, God, you go a long way towards rebounding and staying in fellowship to avoiding divine discipline. But this person just simply, again, perpetuates the sin. He resides, as it were, in this state of anger. Well, only God can judge that. There's no believer that's competent to judge that. There's no court that's competent to judge that. And of course, the Ephesians 4:26, also be angry and sin not, also addresses the issue of not letting the sun go down on your anger, of dealing with things by the end of the day, that we are to keep relatively short accounts, and by that, I mean things are to be dealt with on a daily basis. When people perpetuate anger and unforgiveness and all this, one day, 2 days, a week, a month, then it becomes years of this. And I've met people, some believers, some unbelievers, and I mean, they are just professional grudge holders. I mean, they are good at this. And they delight in it, which is really sick, because that is perverse. So, again, this is guilty before the court, but only God can judge this. B, the second situation Jesus uses is far more serious. The believer now engages in verbal insults toward the object of his mental attitude anger. A, like the first example, the object of anger is a fellow believer. B, all three examples deal with a strong and settled anger as opposed to a passing irritation. And we've all had that where you get angry and you flash and okay, you realize, okay, maybe it wasn't important, or it just goes by and you realize, okay, I shouldn't have been angry or whatever else. People can get angry. But we're talking about deep-seated long-term hostilities. Orgizo is the more settled term in this as opposed to, say, thumos. See, the distinction between the first and second case of anger is that the second involves the verbal sin of cursing the object of anger. Raka, D, is a transliteration of an Aramaic word that means imbecile, fool, empty head, or good for nothing. E, the guilt and punishment in this second example is greater than that of the first, as seen in the word Supreme Court, indicating that God considers this at the highest level of his justice. But now he's taken his anger, his perpetuated anger, and now he's added a verbal sin to it too. And I assume this is not an isolated verbal sin, just as the anger is not an isolated anger. It's not a quick, I got mad and I rebounded and got over it. It's, I'm going to sustain this. And that requires a lot of mental work to sustain anger, to just stay mad. I mean, you really have to work at that. Because time, if nothing else, tends to, ameliorate anger. It tends to soften it down. But I've seen people, they're still mad 20 years later over the same thing that got them mad in the first place. And that's just pathetic. Nine, the third case deals with mental attitude anger that manifests itself by the ultimate verbal insult. A, it should be evident that the term brother is not used in this example, leading many to suggest that this is a case that involves an unbeliever attacking a believer. B, in any case, we know that unbelievers do not go to hell based on any sins they've committed. They go to hell due to their unbelief. It's not because they sinned and got angry. God's not sending people to hell for anger. Everybody'd be in hell in that regard. See, the point is that anyone that has allowed their anger to control them, so they verbally deride another person, has incurred enough guilt to go into the fiery hell. D, it has been suggested that the term fool may have a far more serious intent than merely senselessness or foolishness. It may suggest spiritual rebellion or apostasy. And then E, a perfect example of this is the anger that the unbeliever Cain had for his believing brother Abel. Anger that ended in overt murder. Genesis 4 gives us the historical background. Verses 5 and 6, and what set up this anger was the Lord had regard for Abel in verse 4 and for his offering at the end of it there. They brought two different kinds of offerings. Cain brought the produce of the cursed earth, and Abel brought a blood sacrifice. He brought the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Cain, or Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard, so Cain became very angry and his countenance fell. Then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? Well, this ended later on here, verse 8. The Lord tells him in verse 7, if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Cain told Abel, his brother, told him what? Well, we don't know what he told him. It's not ever specifically stated what he told him. But apparently, whatever he told him was designed to lure him out, and who knows what he told him. But it came about that when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. And then 1 John 3:2 provides a commentary on this that indicates that Cain, as all negative volition is, that's perpetuated, killed Abel. And he talks about Cain, we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the evil one. Cain, ultimately, negative volition finds its source ultimately in Satan. And slew his brother. And the word slew there is actually offered him as a religious sacrifice. Apparently, the horrific nature of what Cain did was that God said, God wanted a substitutionary sacrifice, a blood sacrifice. And Cain said, you want a blood sacrifice? Here's one for you. And he killed Abel. And justified it with this religious sort of weird reasoning. And he sacrificed his brother. And for what reason did he sacrifice him? Because his deeds were evil and his brother's were righteous. There's this constant tension that exists between righteousness and unrighteousness, between positive volition and negative volition. So Cain was angry and his anger ended up in murder. And that's the whole point. This is why when a person gets angry, you never know where it's going to end up. That's one of the issues that you have to watch out for. Anger can start out over the smallest thing, you know, salt and pepper, whatever. You know, you're at home, you know, who knows what you get into a fight about? You know. You can say the most obsequious thing sometimes, the most benign thing. Somebody can take offense to it. And then, boom, you've got a fight. Over what? Typically nothing. But it could be something important. And once it starts, where's it going to end? I mean, it can end up in name-calling, throwing, broken stuff. You know, the police getting called out. Where's it going to end? You never know. And you end up in jail. Or somebody ends up dead. And this, the danger with anger is it so quickly escalates. And it doesn't take long, and I bet everybody here could give their little testimony. We'll start with you, Becky. They could give their little testimony about how some little thing set you off, I was kidding, of course. Some little thing set you off, and then boom, you were through the roof and gone. And I mean gone in less than 60 seconds. It's the name of a movie, I think. Gone in 60 seconds. Should be the title for anger. Because the least little thing can escalate to where great damage is done. That is another thing about this sin. It's not only very damaging internally to the person that engages in it. I mean, great physical, emotional, and spiritual damage can be done when people do not deal with this. So, again, the whole process, the whole complex of jealousy, anger, envy, all these things, bitterness, wrath, strife, unforgiveness, all this stuff is not uninterconnected. It is interconnected in some ways. And one thing can lead to another, lead to another, lead to another. And implacability, that's another part of all of this. People become incorrigible in their anger. They don't want to get out of it. And my personal experience with anger is that it's not a fun sin. I mean, there are sins that are probably more fun than anger. How do you feel when you're angry? Do you feel good? I mean, when that adrenaline's pumping and you're just... No, nobody. I don't think anybody feels good. And it certainly is a warning to us that, hey, something. And how quick, and again, it can be the least little thing, but how quick can you get just completely out of control? I mean, it can literally happen in a snap. And that's the deal. All you got to do is snap. And then you take something like anger and add alcohol to it or some other factor, stress and pressures from the job and whatever else you may, financial pressures. These things can lead you to snap and get into all kinds of trouble. So the challenge is, of course, as we review all this, is to keep it before us, to recognize the danger in these things, to acknowledge that it's real, and to confront it and deal with it when we find it in our lives. D, believers are specifically told to avoid anger when attempting to take in Bible doctrine. James 1:18 through 21, of course, we've read these a number of times, but this is... the issue here. Well, actually, it should be 19, I guess. I concluded 18. This you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God, therefore putting aside all filthiness and all that remains of wickedness. And clearly, anger would be a part of that. Receive in humility, receive the word implanted, which is able to save your souls, to deliver your souls. One, the protocol by which adjusting believers are to operate is seen in verse 19. Quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. Two, the anger of man does not advance the plan of God. It is not compatible with being in fellowship and does not comply with God's righteousness. And we're talking about sinful anger here. Obviously, I'm not talking about righteous indignation. The sinful anger of man doesn't advance God's plan in any way. People get angry and they think they're helping God. You're not helping God when you're angry. God doesn't need you to get mad to help him. God's done, let's see, how long's he been around again? Oh, from eternity past. And you've been here how long? 30, 40, 50 years? I think God was doing okay before you got here. And I'm sure he'll be doing okay when you leave. And your little STA anger geared at whatever doesn't advance his plan. Three, the believer that is truly humble, acclimated to the authority of God as given to the pastor teacher, having isolated the STA via rebound and maintaining the slow to anger mentality, is the only one that is truly teachable and able to receive the word implanted. And again, true teachability demands more than simply just assembling and sitting here. And just the same way, I mean, if you went to any school, pick elementary school, middle school, high school, college, there are people who are not teachable. And why? There's various factors and reasons as to why. One, maybe they think they already know it all. Well, if you think you already know it all, it's going to be hard to learn from me or any other teacher in that, for that matter. So, and again, while we insist on overt humility, you have to be quiet and sit and pay attention and at least act interested, even if you're not, and not do distracting stuff that bothers other believers, true humility obviously comes from the soul. You have to be willing to sit and listen and all of that. That's the challenge. And every pastor who's ever been in the pulpit has had to do this as a part of his training. You have to sit there and listen. And you might say, okay, he mispronounced this word, he did this, he did that. And if you're trained, I mean, you see all kinds of things in the teaching that the average believer doesn't see. Because you just, I mean, you're more skilled at it. You're more able to deal with it. So you have to sit there and be humble and listen and say, okay, well, this is the guy God's got for me. This is the one God the Holy Spirit's established in this particular neck of the woods. And then to receive it. And sometimes the word and plan is going to go against you. Sometimes it's going to encourage you. Sometimes it'll make you mad. Sometimes it'll make you happy. You have all kinds of emotional responses because the word covers all kinds of things. I mean, the realm of doctrine is broad. Well, for the process is this process is necessary if one desires to be delivered from the domination of the sin nature. If you're going to conquer and stay on top of your STA, you're going to have the doctrine to do it. Clearly, some people have this idea that simply human ingenuity and human determination can win in the Christian life for them. It cannot. You cannot defeat the flesh with the flesh. The old pull up your bootstraps, keep a stiff upper lip. The flesh cannot overpower the flesh. The flesh is by definition, that which is flesh, and that which is spirit. And so the sin nature dominates people because they don't submit themselves to this whole process. And they become dominated by the sin nature, and of course that leads to the next thing, the worst thing, loss at the bema seat. That ultimately, when your works get judged, as they're tried by fire, what kind of doctrine you built with? Did you build with sound doctrine, the gold, silver, precious stones of the faith? Or did you build with wood, hay, straw, human viewpoint, doctrines of demons, weird ideas that you had that you thought were okay? Those things are going to burn. You're going to be lost, things that come out of that. Well, parents are specifically warned against provoking their children to anger by unrealistic expectations or demands. Ephesians 6:4. And Colossians 3:8 is just a parallel, so we don't need to look at that one. They both substantially say the same thing. Actually, Colossians 3:8 isn't right. I don't know how I got that one, but it's Colossians. That should be Colossians 3:21. Fathers, do not exasperate your children so that they may not lose heart. And again, the danger I've observed is this issue of parents trying to live through their children. Trying to push them in areas where they want them pushed. Trying to direct their lives inappropriately. We're not talking about providing good parental guidance and leadership and all that. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people that put unrealistic expectations on their children. Do not provoke your children to anger in Ephesians 6:4, and Colossians would add, and drive them into depression. That's the whole do not lose heart thing. And discourage them to the point where they don't want to deal with it. Again, whenever dealing with children, it's got to be age appropriate, got to be tailored to their little niche, gender appropriate. Don't send your football, daughters out to try out for the football team. I don't care what the hell the cosmos is saying today. There isn't a woman in their right mind that could compete with a man on a football field. I mean, I'm not even in good shape, and I bet I could run over most of you. I'm 50-something. You want to go out and try to compete with Warren Sapp, or Brett Favre? And he's retired now. But you can't, gender-appropriate stuff. It's probably not best to teach your son how to knit. There's nothing wrong with knitting. But, he's going to take some real abuse at school if he carries his knitting with him. And you've seen children that their parents push them in the wrong direction and all of this. It's got to be, it should be age appropriate, gender appropriate, and all kinds of other factors. And don't take your wrath out on your children when they don't live up to your expectations. They're always going to let you down at some point. As a parent, you just have to recognize that. They're going to do things, and you're going to scratch your head, and you're going to say, by God, I know I taught them better than that. And then you're going to get depressed and want to blow your brains out. Well, you can't do that either. They're going to do what they're going to do. They have volition, and even if it's stupid, at a certain level, all you can do as a parent is just do your best. One, parents are not to discipline their children out of anger or frustration. Since such actions do not advance the plan of God, that's the whole idea of being angry. there in James. The anger of, and plug your name in there, this verse is for you, does not achieve the righteousness of God. And I've seen parents do this, you know, they spank their kids because they're mad, you know, calling them names, that's inappropriate, hitting them anywhere other than the rear end. I'm not saying a child might not be smacked on the hand because you tell them don't touch that and they touched it, and you give them a little pop, that's fine. I'm talking about smacking them in the face, that's inappropriate. I'm talking about using wire coat hangers, that's inappropriate. You know, and I got whipped with a lot of things when I was a kid, from a wooden spoon to a belt to a willow switch. I particularly didn't like the willow switch. Those things draw blood. Now, today, my dad would be in prison for child abuse. He didn't abuse me. I deserved it. Why doesn't anybody ever step up and say, you know, this kid deserved this? He brought it on himself. He was told not to do this. And so, again, you don't discipline them out of anger and frustration. We always had a rule. If the kids got to me to the point where I was mad about it, I'd put them aside. I didn't know what timeout was. But I'd put them in timeout while I took a timeout, so I could get myself under control. And, you know, you don't spank them when you're angry. That's inappropriate. You got to have some sense about yourself. You're trying to teach your children that discipline comes out of love. When you do that out of anger, what message does that send? Discipline comes because of anger. So all I got to do is try not to make him angry, and I'll never get disciplined. No, discipline is done out of love for the good of the child. Contrary, again, to Doc Spock and all the people we've got today, you don't want to frustrate the little child's STA. If he wants to run in the street, let him run in the street. Yeah, well, that won't last long. Somebody will run over him. And then you know, I saw the deal. And, of course, today, everything's completely out of control. I mean, it's just insane. I saw today on the news, I don't know if you saw the deal, but this autistic kid apparently was weird and wandered out and drowned in the pond in the backyard. And so immediately now they've got to check out. We think the mom might have been on the computer while the kid drowned. One, when was it a sin to be on the computer? I'm not saying she couldn't have been more diligent, but is this premeditated? Is this murder? Is this, you know, negligence? I don't think so. You know, so obviously, as a parent, you got to watch them, especially when they're young. I mean, you got to keep an eye on them all the time. And that's why, you know, as they develop responsibility and you see that they can handle it, then you give them more and more freedom. Well, two, a child should be disciplined consistently and fairly, employing appropriate verbal and physical correctives. You know, a five-letter string of foul language ending with "you little retard" probably is not appropriate. Probably. I can't imagine a situation in which it would be. But expletives deleted, they should be deleted when you're dealing with your child. And that's why you can't deal with this in anger. That's when people do that kind of stuff. So appropriate verbal correctives. You obviously do not want to belittle the child. That's another thing. I've made this point. I hate it when I hear parents, positive parents, telling the kid in front of people, "You need a rebound." Well, maybe the kid does, but that doesn't help the situation, in my opinion. One, all you've done is belittle them right in front of everybody else. They might need to rebound, but I wouldn't do it publicly. If I need to rebound, wouldn't you rather be taken aside and told privately? Or, you know, announce it from the pulpit, "You need to rebound." Well, that's not helpful, in my opinion. Again, spanking is the biblical corrective that God advocates when words do not get the job done. The fact is, all children are going to push the boundaries. That's why they're kids. They're trying to figure out where the boundaries are. As a righteous parent, your job is to teach them where they are. And then when they cross them, it's to make it sting so they don't cross them again. And you have to get smart. As they get older, you know, spanking becomes inappropriate at a certain point. They get to a certain age. Have to figure out other ways to discipline them. One of the things I've noticed with almost everybody in the world, you hit them in the pocketbook. That's where a lot of people live. "All right, I can't spank you anymore. That's fine. You do this or we're going to have a penalty structure here. And here's what the deal is going to be." So, again, sometimes you have to be creative. You have to think outside the box. But again, verbal abuse, physical abuse, this is all inappropriate. And again, especially when it stems out of anger. Proverbs 13:24, he who withholds his rod hates his son. But he who loves him disciplines him diligently. 22:15, all these come right out of Proverbs, of course. 22:15, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. And I don't mean it's just there a little bit. It says it's bound up in there. You know, it's intertwined with his little psyche. And you got to knock that foolishness out of him. And what's the best way? The rod of discipline will remove it far from him. And spanking works, contrary again to public opinion today and to the goofy ideas of negative unbelievers out there. And even negative believers who fall into this stuff and say it doesn't work. I guarantee you it worked. I only got one swat when I was in elementary school, and that was enough. And I take it back, I got two. Just remembered the other one. So, you know, and you know what I was more worried about than the swat? Having to tell my dad. Because he wasn't going to be happy. And he wasn't happy. And then I got into trouble one day. I remember I mouthed off to the teacher and... you know, and the teacher said, you know, okay, you think you know so much. So she threw me out of her class. And I'm forced to go across the hall. And she goes, go and sit in this other classroom. She put me over there. Well, my dad shows up at the school that day for some God reason only known to God. I'm not in my class. Where's Ron? I threw him out to the other class. It's a loud mouth. Said he could do better. You know the words you hated to hear? I'll talk to you when we get home. That meant we were doing more than talking. And I wasn't talking. And so I got, but a couple of swats and that was all it took. I didn't get in any more trouble after about the sixth grade. That's when, you know, at sixth grade, you're kind of feeling your oats. You're 12, 13 years old, you know, about that time. You start to become a teenager. And then, of course, you think you really know it all. But, you know, I didn't get in any trouble in junior high or high school. I was like, okay, I don't need any discipline. So, again, the rod, this removes it from them. 23:13 and 14, do not hold back discipline from the child. Although you strike him with the rod, he will not die. He will just sound like he is. You may strike him with a rod and deliver his soul, rescue his soul from Sheol, the way of death. And then Proverbs, the last one here, 29:15. So, the rod and reproof give wisdom. And again, you have to temper it with not only physical correction, there has to be verbal instruction. You raise him in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. You have to have the discipline. But there has to be this reproof, telling them, okay, here's your... And that's one of the things I did when we were raising the kids. I'd always say, okay, I'd make them sit down, stop, okay. Do you know why? Tell me why you're in trouble. You know, it'd be something like, well, because my sister got me in trouble. No. That's not it. Do you know why you're getting spanked? Because I got caught. Yeah, that's one reason. It's not the real reason, though. Let's get to the root matter here. Why are you getting disciplined? And so I'd always force them to tell me, make it plain. Okay, no, or if they weren't, or sometimes kids are just not clear on it for whatever reason, because they're dumb. They're not clear on it, or maybe they're just playing dumb, who knows. But then, you know, you spell it out to them. No, you're in trouble for this. You know, whatever it was they did, and then spell it out to them if they don't get it. So three, while there may be those that abuse this principle, and I know there are people who are abusive, but I don't. That's not the deal for the positive believer. We're not here to abuse people, especially not children. It does not change the fact that the principle is valid. See, that's one of the things people want to do. Well, people abuse this, so therefore you can't do it. Wrong, 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 wrong. Every principle of God is abused by somebody. So what are we going to do? We'd have to throw out the whole Bible if we do that. That's not appropriate. You should be wary of anyone that is opposed to the wisdom of God on this matter. Four, parenting is demanding work and must be done in fellowship, employing the doctrinal principles learned in Bible class. It is not to be accomplished through a reign of terror that demoralizes the child. And one of the things, of course, is when you deal with children, it's a pretty well-known fact that men tend to be the more stern disciplinarians in the family. Moms tend to be, you know, so who is the kid going to approach first when they want something? Mom. Why? Well, dad might say no. And, you know, as a dad, of course, you get to be the bad guy most of the time because you can see, oh, there's a hole in here. I can see where this is leading. This isn't good. No. So you get to say no. Well, get used to not being liked if you're going to raise children because they're not going to like you for a while. And that just is the way life is. Okay, well, our time's up. We're really going to have to stop there. So we'll read those verses on Wednesday and continue on. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying these things. May God, the Holy Spirit, enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.